Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Michael Snidell, registration number 14376. I represent the plaintiff, Redford Golf Media Center. I'd like to address two issues today. From our appeal, I think the issue that most bears further discussion may be the scope of the new trial in the event that this court were to reverse. I also would like to spend some time addressing the cross appeal. Obviously, that raises some complicated issues as well, and I'm also hoping to reserve a few minutes at the end.
That will be up to you to keep track of.
Thank you, Your Honor. If the court does reverse on either of the first two issues raised in our brief, the assumption of risk instruction or the inconsistent jury verdicts, then liability must be reallocated. And it would be impossible to fairly reallocate liability if some of the parties are missing from the retrial. That's so because the issues and evidence on the liability of all of the parties are intertwined. And that is as true of the willful and wanton finding regarding the coaches as it is of any other liability finding. For example, the willful and wanton finding is inseparable from the warnings issue. To the extent that the jury were to find that the warning is inadequate, that it is less likely to find that the coaches were willful and wanton because they would not have received proper warning or instructions to disregard, talking about reckless disregard. On the other hand, if the jury were to find that the warning was inadequate, then that raises the issue of whether the coaches were willful and wanton by ignoring it, having been properly warned, having been effectively instructed.
But you just said if it's inadequate, sorry, I think you maybe reversed yourself. If it's found to be inadequate, say, what's the effect on the willful and wanton?
Okay, if it's found to be inadequate, then it's less likely that the jury would find the coaches willful and wanton. I might have got them reversed. That's entirely possible. If the jury finds the warning adequate, then it is more likely to find the coaches willful and wanton because the coaches will then have been effectively and properly instructed on safe use of the helmet.
But the jury found the warning to be inadequate in the last trial.
It did.
And nonetheless found the coaches not to be willful and wanton.
Well, that goes hand in hand. Mm-hmm. Because they found the warning to be inadequate, and because the warning was inadequate, the coaches were less likely to be willful and wanton because they had not been properly warned.
But you're not urging that finding be reviewed, that the adequacy finding be reviewed. You're saying leave
no, well, actually, if we have a retrial, everything goes back to zero. If we have a retrial, all the claims and issues are going to be part of that retrial. And so, from our point of view, it's not just the coaches who go back to zero. It's not just the coaches who will go back and start over. It's also the plaintiff. The plaintiff would lose the verdict that he has already got on the warnings issue. Mm-hmm. And so it would be anomalous, I think, to send the trial back in a situation in which the plaintiff, because of errors that prevented him from fully collecting and fully compensated, were to now have to start over with half the liability behind this.
Let me flip it the other way. If we end up affirming on the grounds that the warning was inadequate, rejecting Riddell's counter-appeal, but finding that the verdict was screwed up, and we reverse for a refinding of fault, why do the Wolf and Watton findings have to be revisited?
Because the law says that if there is a reversal, then all issues must be retried. The retrial must include.
Not if they're separable.
Unless they're separable.
Intertwined.
Okay. And what I'm talking about, and perhaps I should make that clear.
No, I understand you're arguing that. I want to understand why they're intertwined, given the fact if the warning is found to be inadequate, which is what the jury found, and they're not willful and wanton, why does the willful and wanton issue have to be retried if we leave the inadequacy of the warning in place?
Because then we would end up in the same situation that happened in Tryon. In Tryon, as the court may remember, the the manufacturer was completely exonerated in the first trial. And the error only went to the instructions having to do with the tow truck operator. And so they had a second trial where the tow truck operator comes in, blames the whole thing on the manufacturer, avoids liability by blaming an absent party from whom the plaintiff cannot collect. And the court reversed because it said the issues of the liability of the parties were inextricably intertwined. You can't look at one without it having an effect on the other. And so we're not talking about whether or not the error affected the willful and wanton finding. We're talking about if there is a reversal, what is a new trial about? Like, how would a fair new trial be conducted?
If we agree with you that the inconsistent verdict requires a new trial, do we need to address the assumption of risk instruction, or is that better left for the trial court in its discretion to revisit the issue depending on how the evidence is going to play out in a second trial?
Well, I would ask the court to address it. And the reason for that is that I think the error that the court committed here, thinking, well, football's dangerous, so he didn't play football, so he must have assumed some risk, I think it is probably a fairly a common error and a common way of thinking, when we all know, of course, that the assumption of risk has to do with whether you assume the risk of the particular negligence that caused your injury.
This young man was a senior, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
And so he played on the varsity team before?
I believe he has.
Has he been through that drill the year before as well?
I don't know if he's been that. I don't think that's a record. Yeah. Whether that drill had ever been used before.
It would be unusual if it hadn't.
I assume it would be, but I would
be
guessing.
Okay,
and I don't want to guess. And so, for that reason, I think that the coach, although the coaches spent a great deal of time talking about willful and wanton and focused largely on that in their briefing, that I think it's just another liability finding that has to be retried along with all of the other liability findings to have a fair trial. It would not be practical, it would not be fair to send plaintiff back to square one, having given up the verdict he already got because of errors that occurred, and then give him a trial which half the liable parties are missing.
Isn't that a risk the plaintiff may have undertaken by taking this appeal?
Well, he always takes some risk by undertaking an appeal, but I don't think it's a risk he undertook because I think the case law is very clear that the scope of the new trial has to include all parties and all claims, and we knew that going in.
And the damages?
And damages.
Why?
Damages, I think damages is a closer question, but I do think that damages have to be in the trial. Because
why?
Damages are an okay.
Sorry, Mike.
I'll tell you why. Damages are an aspect of liability. In order to find somebody liable, you have to find that they cause damages. And in order to find whether or not they caused the damages, you have to know what the nature and extent of the damages were, so you can try to contrive them to the causal events.
There are cases like this where the case is sent back for retrial and liability or apportionment, and the lawyers are told, and the court's told, just tell the jury we stipulated this is the amount of damages. There's a number of cases like that.
And you are, I'm not at all doubting that. I'm more familiar with the converse line of cases where damages are sent back. Right, so, which I think is a different question. But I think in this case, in order to apportion liability and determine causation, certainly the jury's going to have to look at the extent of the nature of the damage. So I think it is going to be part of the trial.
Counsel, can we, before your time runs out, can we talk about the failure to warn issue that you had hoped to address?
The which one?
I thought you said you wanted to address the failure to warn, the cross appeal.
Yes, the cross appeal, and I really appreciate the court directing me towards that because I do want to address it. There are two aspects to the cross appeal, two fundamental questions. One is whether a warning is necessary to ensure safe use such that a duty arises, and the second is whether there was evidence to support the jury verdict that the warning here was inadequate for that purpose. I think what I'm going to do is save the sufficiency argument for rebuttal, but I want to talk briefly about the duty. And oddly enough, the first thing I'd like to say about duty has to do with a preservation issue. We did, I think, fully brief the preservation issue as to whether the raising it in the JNOV would preserve it. But one thing that wasn't talked about is that, and the reason this came up is because in the reply brief, for the very first time, which is a problem, Riddell talks about the scope of the duty. In their opening brief, they said, we have a duty. In the reply brief, they said, if we have a duty, it doesn't include the duty to warn about seeking medical care. So they raised the scope of the duty. And that got me thinking. So I went back and looked at the instructions. And as it turns out, instructions 24 and 27 define the scope of the duty. And Riddell did not object to those instructions. And so I think we have a preservation problem that goes beyond what was argued in the briefs. Now, Riddell does have a duty. They marketed this as a protective device. They knew users would rely on it. That's foreseeable. They knew the protection was limited. And that gives rise to the duty not only to warn, but to provide instructions on safe use. And so even if we are to address that argument that was raised for the first time in the reply brief, which I think, by the way, is really more of a sufficiency argument than a duty argument, because the duty is instruct on safe use. The sufficiency argument is what do those instructions have to be. But regardless of how we look at it.
Okay. As long as you've raised it, instruction 27, inform the jury, told the jury, the warning must inform the ordinary user of any specific risk of harm that may be involved in any intended or reasonably expected use of BOC. What specific risk of harm is not advised to the
Well, there are two answers to that. That gets me to the sufficiency argument, but I'm happy to address it. There's two aspects to that.
Time's running down.
So very briefly. First of all, there is a difference in the wording between Dr. Lowe's warning and Riddell's warning, which is that Dr. Lowe warns that body blows can cause brain injury. And that is very significant here because Riddell spent probably half the trial trying to prove that there was no direct hit to the head, that there was a forearm. And if Riddell's right, then we got a subdural hematoma here that arose from a body blow. And so that wording, that difference in wording, as much as they downplay it, is highly significant. Secondly,
but there was no dispute that the boy suffered a concussion and a subdural hematoma as a result of it, was there?
Yes, but the warnings issue, the sufficiency has to do with whether or not they warned that a body blow can cause.
But if he suffered a concussion, what's the difference if it's caused by a body blow or he ran into the wall?
Because it makes it more likely that a coach or a player will recognize it if they go, oh, he had a body blow, but he is having some symptoms. I now know that this could cause a subdural hematoma. I better look at this more closely.
Doesn't Riddell's warning talk about contact in football can cause serious injury?
It does, but that brings me to the second part very briefly, which is that Dr. Lowe found, and I think the jury agreed, that regardless of the wording, it was ineffectively communicated. Size, placement, design, urgency, lack of facilitation system, all missing, and it doesn't matter what you say if it doesn't effectively communicate.
What's the purpose of the facilitation system? To make sure that the user knows of the warning, correct?
Not just knows of the warning, but provides additional information. If you remember Dr. Lowe's testimony, the facilitation system would go more into the symptoms you're looking for, more into the kind of steps you need to take when you see those symptoms.
With all due respect, I think the symptoms were more explained in the helmet's warning than in hers, but I won't argue with you about that. Is this a fact that was I think, a trial? The coaches read the warning to the players at the beginning of the season, which would have been shortly before this practice?
Another issue raised for the first time in the reply brief, but I'll address it anyway. The fact that it's read...
Actually, it's at page 5 of their opening brief.
Oh, is it? It does not matter if it's read to the players if the entire system is inadequate. And you have to remember, this is a sufficiency question. The question is whether there's evidence to support the jury verdict, not whether we would reach a different conclusion.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I thought you just said it doesn't matter what the message is if it's not effectively communicated. Isn't evidence that the coaches got the message and read the message out? That some, not even some evidence, it is indisputable evidence that the message was communicated.
But Dr. Lowe admitted that on her testimony. She said, I know it was read out, and the jury knew it was read out. And she said it was ineffective anyway, because the design of the warning didn't draw attention to itself, the wording of the warning was inadequate, it was insufficiently urgent, and it was lacked a facilitation system.
Was the wording inadequate because it didn't talk about a head jerking?
That is the primary difference. But that is not the whole basis of Dr. Lowe's opinion. And you have to remember, the question is there sufficient evidence for the jury to have made this finding?
Thank you.
I'll reserve my 30 seconds.
I think it's practical matter, your 30 seconds in the hole, but let me address that. To defense counsel, I'm going to give plaintiff's counsel an extra 4 minutes because of he was essentially prevented from saving any rebuttal time by all the questions. If you want to reallocate, just take a second and talk among yourselves. So you now got 19 minutes. So let's just say 20. You now got 20 minutes rather than 15. So if you want to talk among yourselves about how to reallocate that, and then I'll give 5 minutes to plaintiff's counsel for his rebuttal.
Terrific. I just understand you. We have 20 minutes for our side.
Total. Right.
Thank you. And Your Honor, I will reserve whatever time I
have. You will have 5 minutes.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Shannon Stevenson on behalf of Riddell 35542. Stu Stuller is here on behalf of the coaches, and I intend to reserve 5 minutes to allow Mr. Stuller to address issues particular to the coaches. I want to begin with the failure to warn claim where Mr. Zwiebel left off, and I want to articulate what I think are three critical and undisputed points that Your Honor seem to have already latched onto that underlie each of our arguments with respect to that issue. The first, of course, is that Riddell provided a very detailed warning in this case. Clearly warns that no helmet can prevent all injuries, head injuries in football, cautions against misusing the helmet, it identifies the symptoms of a potential head injury, and most importantly here, it ensures that players don't do anything to exacerbate that injury, and it gets the player to the people who are most capable of making medical decisions about that player's particular situation. His coaches, trainers, and parents. Now, there's also no dispute here that this warning was known. The coaches, as you pointed out, Judge Daly, I think, read the warning out loud to the team every year, and there was no dispute at all that either plaintiff or the coaches didn't know the contents of Riddell's warning.
Did this warning suggest that the risk would be incurred only when you misuse the helmet, such as spearing people, butting people, things like that?
I certainly don't believe so, Your Honor. The very first sentence of the warning says, no helmet can prevent serious head and neck injuries that you might sustain participating in football. It then goes on to warn about misuse of the helmet, and then goes on and gives symptoms of a potential head injury, but I don't think that it by any means suggests that you could only incur that injury if you misused the helmet. The third critical aspect, I think, of this case is the plaintiffs haven't disputed that if this warning had been followed, plaintiff wouldn't have been injured. Now, the coaches here recognized that Rhett had symptoms of a head injury. They were assessing him for that. And they appreciated the potential risk of brain injuries. In fact, Coach Randy Bogano testified that he understood that concussion could lead to very, very serious brain injuries.
Did he say they recognized that the boy had a concussion?
Yes, and they suspected that he had a concussion. They were running field tests on him. And in fact, they said the reason why they told him when he was going home, make sure to tell your grandma not to let you go to sleep, was because they suspected they had a concussion. And I believe Coach Mike Rudolph even said, I had a concern that he could go into a coma. So they were clearly aware of the seriousness or the potential seriousness of the risks involved. But again, rather than telling Rhett's parents, which Riddell's warning specifically instructed them to do, they sent Rhett home unsupervised for hours. The coaches admitted that that was negligent, that that's not what they should have done. And plaintiff argued at trial that if either Rhett's mother or his grandmother had been advised of Rhett's injury and symptoms, they would have taken him to the hospital where he would have gotten prompt treatment. And so the real complaint that plaintiff has here is not that Riddell's warning was inadequate, it's that it wasn't followed. Now, let me take those 3 points and put them in the specific context of our argument, first with respect to duty.
Wasn't part of the argument basically is the warnings weren't made with a sense of urgency or didn't convey a sense of urgency, so that a coach perhaps suspecting he might go into a coma would think, uh-oh, this is a little bit more, you know, it's more urgent, we need to, somebody needs to take action now as opposed to wait.
Your Honor, I'm just not aware of any authority that imposes a duty on a product manufacturer if they've accurately, if they've provided the right information in their warnings, and the warning has been delivered to the user, that there is some additional warning to ensure that the user then does the right thing with the information. That is just beyond the scope of duty as I've ever seen it articulated in any products liability case.
There are several cases in the pharmaceutical area that specifically say that the warning may be found to be deficient because it does not convey the urgency or exigency of an adverse reaction.
Well, Your Honor, I think, again, here, the evidence in this case is to the contrary. First of all, the coaches had received the warning, and they certainly understood the seriousness of the risk. There's no testimony to the contrary on that in this case. And so let me go directly then to the issue of sufficiency of evidence, which is, assuming there was a duty, whether Riddell met that duty in this case.
Now, are you assuming that the duty would include conveying some sense of urgency?
Correct, though. Although, Your Honor, I continue to dispute that once the warning has accurately conveyed the information, and just to spend a bit more time on that, the warning here, it talks about serious head and neck injuries. It talks about paralysis and death. It specifically warns that if you don't follow the warning, you could can lead to a more serious or fatal brain injury. I mean, these are very serious warnings. So I think when you convey that type of information, you are satisfying any duty you have to accurately convey the urgency of the situation. Now, to get to the sufficiency of the evidence, here obviously we contend that plaintiff did not meet his obligations to present evidence on the standard of care or the breach of the standard of care or causation in this case. Now, Dr. Laux said there were sort of two categories, I think, of where her criticisms came from. The first were related to the appearance of the warning, as in the type wasn't big enough, or it was in the wrong place. Now, she didn't propose any other specific alternatives. She just sort of nitpicked at Riddell's warning. Now, again, we know that the warning in this case, all of those complaints relate to whether the warning was attracted the attention of the users. And again, here, we know the users understood what the warning said.
Just for the record, I didn't think we'd have to look at the helmet, but now I'm wondering, we may. Is any print on the warning in a separate color, orange, red, anything like that?
No, I believe all of the print is in black and white. At least I haven't seen the helmet that's down at the district court, but in the one I've seen, it is in black and white. Mm-hmm. And the other problem, of course, with respect to those particular complaints is that Dr. Laux, you know, said, well, I'm not sure I like your size of your type, and I'm not sure that, maybe I would put an orange exclamation point on it. These are very minor differences that she's suggesting to this warning. And when you have a situation like this, you have to have expert testimony, one, that a reasonable helmet manufacturer would have made those specific changes. And that's critical here, because Riddell can't write a warning just designed for Rhett Rodolphe's situation. It has to write a warning that reaches all of its potential users. And if you're going to change some things about the warning, you're necessarily going to change other things. I think Dr. Laux conceded that most of the information in this warning she thought was very good. And just to highlight that, for instance, she says the type is too small, and I suppose her type would be bigger. But Dr. Laux's proposed warning didn't say anything about, for instance, neck injuries. And she said on cross, well, if I found out through testing that we needed to worry about neck injuries, then I would add that information. And so the fact that Dr. Laux proposed a prototype warning that she said had to be tested in order for her to know whether it would be effective, and that she failed to do any of that testing, that renders her opinion meaningless. That is not an opinion that can support the fact that our warning was inadequate. that a reasonable helmet manufacturer would have given a different warning, or that any of these minor differences in the warning would have actually led to a different result in this case.
She testified that her warning, which we have, you know, multiple copies of, would even fit on the helmet?
She did not, Your Honor, and I think those are the critical problems. Because, as she said, testing is absolutely required to figure out what warning to give here. And because she repeatedly and clearly said, I didn't do any testing in this case, I don't know if this is the right warning, those are the particular problems that would come up if she had tested. Where would she put her warning on the helmet? Is there a better place? We don't know any of these things because she didn't go through her own process to get there.
Didn't she also testify that without regard to any testing, in her expert opinion, what she refers to as the facilitation system would have produced more prompt medical treatment?
She did, Your Honor, and let me address that in two ways. The first thing I want to point out is that she never said that a reasonable helmet manufacturer would do her facilitation system, and just like the warning, her facilitation materials were just prototypes. The second thing is the facilitation system that she mentions, there's no information in there at all about subdural hematoma or the type of brain injury that Rhett had. It is all material that is only related to treatment of concussion. And also, unlike her warning, those materials don't say, go get immediate medical treatment anytime you have symptoms of concussion. The entire point of those is to say, if you think you have a concussion, sit out. Well, that's what Rhett did. It says, if you think you have a concussion, make sure you tell your coaches. Well, that's exactly what Riddell's warning does. So the facilitation materials really are irrelevant to the particular complaint here. And you know, the plaintiff's complaint is Rhett didn't get medical treatment soon enough. There's nothing about the facilitation materials that would suggest he would have gotten any different treatment than he did, or that Riddell's warning suggested that he get.
Didn't she testify that in her expert opinion, with the facilitation system, he would have gotten more prompt treatment?
Yes, she did, Your Honor. And so two responses to that. The first is we objected to that opinion coming in, and that's one of the issues that we raised in the appeal, is that that opinion, because she specifically conceded over and over, she said her facilitation system, I think, in conjunction with her warning. And because she said, I don't know whether any of these warnings would be effective without testing them, that effectively renders that opinion moot. Now, even if it did, I mean, let me back up on that one. So the first point is, we objected to that opinion coming in as speculative because she had conceded that she had no basis to give it. So for that reason, that evidence should be disregarded. And plaintiff doesn't have any other evidence of causation. The second thing is, even if that opinion came in light of her other testimony, that she did not know what an effective warning would be or whether her warning would be effective, and that her facilitation materials were also prototypes, I think all of that renders that opinion so weak that it's not entitled to any weight. And we cited a case that, specifically on this point, the Bork Group case from the United States Supreme Court, that addresses this issue where you have an expert opinion that, even though it's accepted, has such significant weaknesses that it's not any real evidence of the issue.
Is that a case about a patent or something? What's the case that you cited, Brooke?
Yeah, it's the cigarette antitrust case.
Oh, okay.
Liggett case. Okay. Your Honor, there's another point here, which is with respect to the adequacy of Riddell's warning. And that is, again, it's undisputed that if the warning had been followed in this case, that the plaintiff would not have been injured. And I think that is a standalone ground on which the court can find that the warning was adequate as a matter of law.
But, I mean, doesn't that beg the question of whether additional aspects of the warning, like the orange banner, like the facilitation system, would have made it more likely that the coaches would have followed? I mean, it seems to me you're sort of assuming away that scenario.
Right, Your Honor. And again, I think this comes back to where you have a situation like this, where you have a very detailed warning that was known to all of the users, that conveyed a very serious message about the potential risks. And the suggestion is that some minor changes might have, we're not sure, but might have encouraged more prompt treatment.
Well, it's not just might have, that's her opinion. that the jury apparently bought, despite, I assume, very vigorous cross-examination. So it's a matter of opinion. It's not might.
Well, Your Honor, I disagree with that because I don't think Dr. Lax could or did give an opinion that this warning could have made any difference. And because she said herself, I would have to test it to know, and I did not test it.
Did she ever concede that if they had followed the warnings of Riddell, that Rhett would not have suffered serious injury?
I don't believe she was asked that specific question. Your Honor, let me, I want to reserve some time for Mr. Stuller here. So let me go quickly to the inconsistent verdict issue. The standard of review on an inconsistent verdict issue is that if there's any view of the case that renders the verdict consistent, the court has to adopt that view, as long as it's supported by the evidence. Here, of course, we've articulated a view we believe is consistent with the evidence that the jury made a finding that although Frank Pagano was negligent and his negligence didn't cause Rhett's injuries, that they could have also reached the conclusion that Frank Pagano was willful and wanton, and his willful and wanton conduct did cause. And the way the jury verdict was set up here makes this case distinguishable from other cases cited by plaintiff because it specifically refers to Frank Pagano's negligence. And for that, given that is an available and consistent interpretation of the jury verdict, we don't think there's any basis to reverse at all. But I also want to briefly address Mr. Zwiebel's argument regarding the scope of retrial. There are two issues that absolutely do not, cannot be, should not be, there's no reason to retry them. You know, there is a minor error in the jury verdict that I think plaintiff is attempting to capitalize on to retry everything in this case. But the issue of the total amount of damages and the issue of Riddell's liability on the product defect claim are entirely separate from any issues related to apportionment of fault or Frank Pagano's conduct. And there is no reason, evidentiarily related, and they're not logically related in any way to the issues that would remain to be retried. And I don't think plaintiff has articulated any basis on which to retry those. And I'd specifically refer the court to the Kiddo case, particularly with respect to the damages issue. I'm gonna cede the balance of my time to Mr. Stoller.
Thank you, Your Honor. Stu Stella, Kaplan and Ernest, on behalf of Mike Rinoff and Randy Pagano.
At some point in your argument, I would like you to address why, if we grant a retrial, it shouldn't include willful wanton. But when you get to that, it's up to you.
I'm ready to get to it right now. The case that the issue here that makes this case unique from the cases that they're relying upon is the coach's liability does not depend on causal fault. It depends upon whether or not their actions were willful and wanton. That issue was properly submitted to the jury. The jury made a determination that their actions were not willful and wanton. In Tryone, or perhaps that's the way the case name is pronounced, you had three defendants, all of whom's liability were wrapped up in whether or not they caused the injury. In this case, the amount of causal fault is irrelevant to the willful and wanton inquiry. That's the difference here. We can't conflate liability.
It might relate to Riddell's potential liability, wouldn't it?
I'm sorry?
Wouldn't it relate to the amount of Riddell's potential liability?
But you can do that by making designated non-parties. You can have the exact same case, one change. There's two additional names in the designated non-parties, Mike Ridolfi and Randy Pagano. You could have that. And that would be the appropriate thing to do. There's been no prejudice to Rhett as a result of a jury verdict that has not been attacked. As a result of a jury verdict that was based on proper instructions and it was based upon substantial evidence. Sending this back and depriving the coaches of that verdict and exposing them to that when they can be designated as non-parties and the same evidence can be brought in allows you to do that. To get to your question. With respect to this issue of the failure to warn or the adequacy of the warning, again, the coach has read the warning. The question is, the coach is following it. You look at what happened here. It's not that the coaches, it was their awareness of what was going on that was at issue here. you have to understand, this case is not a case where there's been a hit on the football field. You hear the crowd gasp, and there's a player down on the field. This is a young man taking part in a drill that he did participate in the previous year, and walked off, and some minutes later tells the coach that he has a headache and he's dizzy. He did not complain. I got popped in the head. The coach told him to take a break, sit out. The coach found out that the young man had vomited. He went over to the student, and he conducted field tests on him to determine whether or not there was a sign of an injury. There was no sign of an injury. The coaches acted cautiously, trying to use their caution as evidence of willful and wanton conduct, discourages coaches from being cautious. That's the difficulty here. And then, with respect to the adequacy of the warning, there's really not a good argument here for how that would have changed what the coaches did, what the coaches knew. Again, at every step of the process here, the coaches took cautious steps to find out if there was an injury, and every one of those cautious steps indicated to them that there was not a head injury.
The adult warning said, tell the parents. Did the coaches tell the parent or the grandmother?
The coaches left it to the student to tell the grandmother.
It says don't return to practice to get medical clearance. Did they get a medical clearance?
I'm sorry?
The Riddell warning says don't return to practice till you get a medical clearance. Did the coaches get the boy a medical clearance?
That's if there has been some sort of blow to the head. At the time, there was no recognition that this young man had suffered a blow to the head that would have caused him a head injury.
Ms. Stevenson told us a few minutes ago they suspected a concussion. Do you disagree with that?
Anytime a student is dizzy or has a headache, they are going to do that. That's, again, caution. That doesn't indicate that there's an awareness that there's a concussion, especially when you do the field concussion tests that were appropriate and they come back negative. Thank you, Your Honors.
You have 5 minutes.
May it please the court. Riddell argues that if the warning had been followed, then Rhett would not have been injured. That is not a duty argument. That is a causation argument. And that means that the only question is whether there was sufficient evidence to support the jury finding that the inadequate warning caused the injury. And clearly there is, although Riddell wants to argue it as if it's de novo review, it is not. And there is evidence on which the jury could find that if the coaches had acted sooner, Rhett would not have been injured, and that they would have acted sooner if Dr. Lowe's facilitation system and urgent warning system had been in place.
They also would have acted sooner under Riddell's warning, wouldn't they?
If it had been sufficient, that assumes sufficiency. The problem is their argument, as Judge Webb pointed out, assumes the sufficiency of their warning, when in fact that's the very issue. Is the warning sufficient? And the jury found it was not.
But sometimes I'm wondering, and you know, I haven't read the entire transcript, but I'm wondering whether or not there's a difference between, hey, this is a better warning, and a better warning than Riddell. That doesn't mean Riddell's warning is defective or insufficient.
Well, if that's what the jury found, that's what we would have. But that's not what the jury found. The jury believed Dr. Lowe. And whether, you know, regardless of what anybody thinks about Dr. Lowe's testimony in hindsight, the jury believed it. And the jury reached a verdict based on that testimony.
And
we can't just say...
Based on material differences in the wording, in the location, in the size, and the number of warnings?
Those were all things that Dr. Lowe talked about. And which one of those the jury relied on, if they relied on all of them, of course, it's a black box. We don't know. We do know. Is that when you look back at the record, the only question is, was there sufficient evidence to support causation?
Is the difference in all these things a question of fact for the jury to resolve, or does a court have a role in determining whether or not there are material differences in these things?
Well, first of all, here, because it wasn't raised until after the trial, the court never had an opportunity.
I'm talking about this court.
Okay. No, I think the only question for this court under the proper standard of review is whether there's evidence to support the jury verdict, not whether the court would have reached a different result. The second thing I'd like to talk about is very briefly, because we argued it in the briefs, has to do with this testing issue. The question is not the adequacy of Dr. Lowe's verdict. They act as if that's the issue. The issue is the adequacy of Riddell's verdict. And what Dr. Lowe did was she critiqued it and said it's inadequate. She said, sure, mine has to be tested more, but I can tell you that theirs is inadequate for reasons A, B, C, D, and E.
Did she express a specific opinion on what the standard of care was for a football helmet manufacturer?
Well, I think she did in a general sense, because she's a human factors person, and she says it's no different whether it's space shuttles or football helmets or washing machines. The question is whether, given the environment that it's in, which in this case is a lot of testosterone-laden young men running around on a football field, being pushed by their coaches, the question is, under those circumstances, which she studied, whether what would be necessary to make sure these people get the message. And that's the standard she used. What is, under these circumstances, going to effectively communicate the warning? The third thing I'd like to address is Riddell's argument about the product defect. I think that's really no different with regard to the scope of the trial. That's really no different than any other issue like the willful and wanton. It is inextricably bound up with the other issues. You can't look at the warnings issue without looking at product defect, because the reason for the warning is the limitations and defects in the helmet. That's what gives rise to the duty. Also, to the extent, it's also tied up with the coach's liability. To the extent the product is defective, the coaches would be less liable. They would be found not to have been the cause of the injury. And vice versa, the converse would be true as well. So that is bound up, just like the willful and wanton argument is bound up. It's no different. The final thing I want to talk about is that although Riddell again focuses on the wording, simply delivering the message in some form is not enough. If you put it in 5-point type under the padding, and you'll see me get the helmet, there are warnings stuffed in under the padding where nobody can see them. Then it's simply not sufficient no matter what it says. I thank the court for its time and patience.
Impressive, counsel.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course. Counsel are excused.